Pleasant good afternoon to you, Montreal.
If you're having trouble, please email sys@ckut.ca. That's sys@ckut.ca.
CKUTT 90.3 FM.
Another reliable communication channel.
I know a place. Ain't no smiling faces. No, lying to the races.
The Biden-Harris team just appointed Professor Shalonda Baker as Deputy Director for Energy Justice at the Department of Energy. Meet her here first, right on Radio EcoShock. We discuss Baker's new book, Revolutionary Power, An Activist Guide to the Energy Transition. Then Dr. Catherine Duffy reveals a tipping point for plants where they become a source of carbon dioxide. It is important science about imminent danger. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. The climate crisis is starting to hit us all now. In this emergency, we don't have a lot of time for distractions. If you think we don't have time for ideas like energy justice, you just don't know Shalonda Baker. Shalonda is a law professor at Northeastern School of Law, that's in Boston. But that's a pretty dull way to describe this voice, powering up from a single-parent poverty in Texas oil country. Shalonda helps colored and indigenous people find power, not abstract power, but the kind that keeps the lights on. And she can help us all understand what needs to come next. Shalonda Baker, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I have to tell you, a publicist sent me a press release about your new book, Revolutionary Power, An Activist Guide to the Energy Transition. But this isn't really my thing. I mean, I'm a well-meaning white male radio host. I feel a little bit intimidated by my own ignorance. I decided to duck. But then I read your book. So here we go.
Oh, great.
Yeah. And it's good. And it brought me along a long way, I think. Why don't we start where you started with that wind power proposal in southern Mexican state of Oaxaca? How could you possibly be even thinking against wind power?
Yes, that journey began back in 2010. I had just left private practice as a lawyer. I'd practiced in Japan and also in the United States, and my work was to build large-scale energy projects. And I left practice right at the height of the financial crisis in search of something better, and I really wanted to make the world a better place. And so I headed down to Mexico, thinking I would make my way through Latin America, but I sort of got captivated by this place called Oaxaca, which is, as you mentioned, in the southern part of Mexico. It's the second poorest state in Mexico and also home to a very rich indigenous culture with around 14 different indigenous groups. And while I was in Oaxaca, I attended a fair at a big city park in Oaxaca City, and I came across a sign tacked to a tree that said, "Come listen to our struggle against wind power," and this is in Spanish. And so I went to the talk, and there were farmers, campesinos, and teachers who actually had been a part of this big teachers' rebellion in Oaxaca, and they were organizing around wind. And what was going on there is that large multinational corporations were displacing and dispossessing communities in this place called the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. And back in 2010, it was the home of about a handful of large-scale mega wind developments. But the people there, I think rightly, saw that it would become the epicenter of Mexico's energy transition, so its transition away from fossil fuels to clean energy. And all of the same sort of problems that we see with fossil fuel were happening in the development of large-scale wind energy there. And so what I realized in that moment was that the transition itself, away from fossil fuels to clean energy, isn't inherently just unless we make it so. And so we have to think about different models and different approaches to development to ensure that we're not replicating the same patterns of inequality in this clean energy transition.
Before we talk about some of the climate war zones from Puerto Rico to California, we need to address a barrier that might keep some of our listeners out of this conversation. Now, you devote a chapter to environmental fundamentalism. What is that?
So the term I use is actually climate change fundamentalism, or I think climate fundamentalism. And it is essentially a narrow focus on averting catastrophic climate change without paying attention to issues of equity. It basically is a reflection of my view that there are certain large environmental groups, as well as those in the environmental movement, who are unwilling to consider issues of equity, lest those issues slow down this transition. And what I argue in the book is that we have to consider these issues together. There's a moral issue in terms of, you know, thinking about those who are going to be the most impacted by climate change. You know, there's no reason why we can't ensure that this transition makes them better off. And I argue that they should be centered in this transition. There's also just a practical issue. I mean, our fates are so intertwined. When there's a major climate event and we have the most vulnerable people, you know, unable to sort of bounce back, that impacts all of us. And so there's sort of a practical issue beyond the moral issue. But I like to sort of lean into the moral aspect of this.
I was wondering if there were parallels between the Black Lives Matter protests during a pandemic. People thought, well, why can't they wait until it's safe to organize in the streets? And the obvious answer is because Black people were being routinely killed by police, murdered. So can we compare that to our situation now with dangerous climate change and the need for environmental justice at the same time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a reckoning right now, and everyone's used that word and it's overused. But I think it's just such a great word to sort of reflect how we are examining so many different systems, particularly in America, and the ways in which those systems routinely operate to harm people of color, communities of color, Black and Brown and Indigenous people. And for us, you know, those of us who come from those communities, the time for this reckoning is long overdue. And so in my mind, the ways in which the criminal justice system have been devastating in communities of color mirror the ways in which the energy system and environmental pollutants are devastating and have been devastating in communities of color for so long.
Yes, you outline in the book that your family, a strong and healthy family, you would think, grew up in the Texas oil country, made a living from it, but quite a few died young. So there's, you know, it looks like it pays, but it one of the wages is death, really.
Yeah, my parents divorced when I was really young, but my dad's family and that branch is from this place called Port Arthur, Texas, which is, as you said, you know, the heart of oil country in Texas, and actually the epicenter and spine of our modern fossil fuel industry. And my mother, you know, we have a different story there, and I talk about that story. And growing up with her, you know, the child of a single parent, you know, that has its own sort of interactions with the energy system. But for people in Port Arthur, there is an intimate relationship with oil and gas. There's an intimate relationship with the petrochemical industry. And in my family, you know, my dad worked actually for the local utility. He grew up, though, in the Carver Terrace housing projects, which is a fence line community right up against, I believe, what is the Texaco refinery. And so, you know, anyone can Google this and see images of kids playing basketball right against this facility with smoke billowing into the air. And the other thing about this area is that people are routinely asked to shelter in place because of the quality of the air, or something has escaped and people need to run inside and cover their windows with plastic and blankets and not go outside. So, you know, again, this is an assault that is routine, and I think we can now all kind of empathize because we've all had to shelter in place in one way or another over the last several months. But this is a place where lives are shortened and, you know, cancer rates are higher. We also have high poverty rates. I mean, this is a low-income Black and Latinx community, also a poor white area. But the main jobs are in these industries that are, in effect, in effect, killing them.
Shalonda, what is energy democracy and where did that idea come from?
It's interesting. You know, over the last several years, we've seen, and I would say the last 5 years or so, we've seen an emergence of the concept of energy democracy, energy justice. And energy democracy is really about having a say in the design of your energy system. And it really has gotten a lot of traction in the UK and in Europe, where there are opportunities to organize around ownership of energy assets. And so we've picked up that term here in the United States, and a lot of advocates, there are kind of a couple different schools of thoughts. One school of thought is energy democracy is making sure that I can participate in this energy transition by putting rooftop solar on my roof and, you know, that type of participation. There is a deep democracy perspective that is espoused by folks like Denise Fairchild and Al Weinrub, who wrote a book called Energy Democracy, in fact. And they say energy democracy is about much more than simply access to rooftop solar. It's about, you know, making the utility a publicly owned or utility or a co-op, a cooperatively owned utility. It's about racial justice and, you know, environmental justice. And for them, the term energy democracy is much broader than the initial sort of economic perspective, I think, that a lot in the environmental movement have latched onto.
You spent some time on the lesser-known Hawaiian island of Molokai. Would you take some time to just describe the struggle that was happening there about energy?
Sure. I love that you asked me about this. I mean, that is actually one of the most memorable parts about my time in Hawaii. I was there, I'm not sure if you mentioned this, but I was there between 2014 and 2016, 17, and I was teaching at the University of Hawaii, and I had the opportunity to state energy transition and all of the issues that a lot of states around the country, around the United States, are witnessing were already playing out there in a very fast-paced way. And so I met some folks from Molokai. So Molokai is a small, small island, and it is also known as one of, it's pretty much known as the indigenous island, the most indigenous island. High percentages of Native Hawaiians, deep, deep traditions and connections to the land and the ocean. And the people there, I mean, there is an abundance. I mean, the island is itself is called the land of abundance in the Native Hawaiian language. So there's so much abundance there, but there's such poverty. And in a state where people pay the highest electricity costs in the country, the people of Molokai pay the highest electricity costs in the state. So we're talking about an extraordinary energy burden. And the people there are really grappling with how to make their grid greener, how to take over the grid, to control it at the community level, and, you know, how to sort of wrest the power away from the interests that were sort of perennially made their mark on the island of Molokai. And so I was there with a group of students. We worked collaboratively with community members, kind of helping to think through an energy plan, community energy planning, which involves a lot of education around the energy system and just sort of getting folks to think beyond the current system and envision a world that is more just and one that is full of possibility. So that struggle actually continues in Molokai. You know, and I say this in the book, I think the state really missed an opportunity to think about the most vulnerable people in the state as they were embarking on their very ambitious clean energy transition.
Radio EcoShock has a lot of listeners in California. What do you see as a couple of pitfalls and promising energy stories emerging there?
California is chock-a-block with advocates from the sort of large green organizations like the Sierra Clubs of the world to grassroots organizations that have been organizing in places like Oakland, and I'm thinking about Asian Pacific Environmental Network here, and in the Central Valley. I mean, it's just sort of shoulder-to-shoulder packed with people who get the energy sector and the energy scene. And so as California was embarking on its cap and trade program, there was a lot of talk in the environmental justice community around what impact that would have on the most marginalized communities that are living in the shadows of old fossil fuel generation. And their argument was that a cap and trade program actually incentivizes the oldest facilities, which are typically located in communities of color, to simply pay for the right to pollute versus lowering their actual emissions. And so what this effectively creates are hotspots, and hotspots where emissions are higher than in other areas, even with a cap and trade program that is designed to diminish overall community emissions, so overall state emissions over a time horizon. And there were early studies indicating that, in fact, that result was true. I think now there are some more recent studies showing that that might not necessarily be the case. But during the regulatory proceeding that, you know, where a lot of the design of the cap and trade program was being fleshed out, we had advocates in EJ, which is to say environmental justice communities, really saying, look, whoa, let's think through this. We don't think this cap and trade approach is going to work. Whereas the big green organizations, which are funded in some cases 100 times fold, 100 fold, you know, more than these grassroots organizations, they were sort of taking the climate change fundamentalist approach, saying, you know, equity is important, but we're really going to just focus on making sure this cap and trade program gets done. And so that was a missed opportunity to create alliances and to build sort of mutual understanding, really capitalizing on the power of these well-resourced organizations and educating them on the issues of environmental justice. So that's a missed opportunity. Now, there is a program that is underway in California that allows for the redistribution of some of the cap and trade benefits to environmental justice communities. And I'm excited to kind of follow that and see how that is being implemented and whether or not it's really moving the needle in the communities that have been so impacted by the fossil fuel industry.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is law professor and eco-justice activist Shalonda Baker, and we are talking about her new book, Revolutionary Power, An Activist's Guide to the Energy Transition. As you know, at least 100,000 Puerto Ricans left for the U.S. mainland after two hurricanes knocked power out on the island in 2017. The electric grid stayed down for months in many parts. What can energy activists learn from that experience?
Wow, I mean, I just want to pause and reflect on the loss of life, you know, that happened as a result of that. I think what we realized as a result of Puerto Rico is that climate change absolutely has an energy nexus, and there's an energy justice nexus. We saw after Hurricane Maria, that those who had access to solar panels, those who had access to generators, which I'm not promoting, but essentially decentralized power sources, were able to bounce back and the most quickly from the hurricane. So I think what Hurricane Maria did and what the Puerto Rico power grid failure really shows is the need for just a rethinking of the infrastructure and, you know, decentralizing generation, as well as, I would argue, decentralizing ownership and providing pathways for folks to have access to energy sources. And again, I would argue for rooftop solar and batteries to create that resilience. So I led a research team that went into Puerto Rico after the hurricane to really interview people and find out about resilience and the terminology of resilience. You know, people were just forced to come together. There were community leaders who sort of became the hub for electricity, became the place where medicines were stored and where people could do laundry. But this is really the role of government. I think we have to figure this out. And Puerto Rico just sort of creates a preview of what is coming. And, you know, to go back to the California story, you know, the wildfires in California and the threat of wildfire in California has led to an energy crisis. So, again, we see a climate justice issue and an environmental justice issue. And those who don't have the resources to replace medicines that spoil, to replace refrigerators full of food that spoil. I'm thinking back to my own childhood where my mom, you know, struggled so much to make sure that we had food on the table. For her to lose a week's worth of food would have been devastating for our family. This is the emergency that we face and why energy access and decentralized distributed energy access is so crucial in this climate change moment.
And you talk about solar segregation and a really great part on how vested interests have used that against renewable energy. Can you give us a spotlight on that one?
Equity is a thread that runs through so many aspects of this transition, and it really runs through the rooftop solar debates. And so right now, we're seeing the cost of rooftop solar panels drop and decrease. And as this is happening, those who were not able to buy their solar panels, you know, in the early days or weren't as attractive to third-party leasing companies, solar developers early on, are now seeing solar as a possibility. And just as they're seeing solar as a possibility, we're seeing entrenched interest, organizations such as ALEC and other conservative interests that are tied to the fossil fuel industry, saying that the more solar that goes on to the grid, the more that poor people will be harmed because they are left to shoulder the cost of maintaining electrical infrastructure. And so there are a lot of debates as to whether or not that's true. But in any case, I call that out as a very disingenuous argument. I mean, the idea that now, in a moment when communities of color and low-income people are just getting the opportunity to own solar and clean energy access, we should shut that down is just sort of preposterous given, and that it hurts them at that, is preposterous given that we have seen the way that these same interests have systematically harmed these communities over time. And so there have been so many dozens of regulatory proceedings opened up around the country to basically slow the growth of solar based on these so-called equity arguments. And their arguments are really economic in nature, and then there are sort of these dog whistles embedded in these arguments saying that this hurts poor people, this hurts Black and brown people, and see the environmental movement really never cared about you anyway. And so, again, my response is, let's think about the source of this information, and let's think about the ways in which those very industries have harmed these communities. And so instead, we need to have creative regulatory action that creates different incentive structures for solar access. You know, for example, let's create an economic incentive to bring rooftop solar into frontline environmental justice communities. Again, these are the very communities that are in the shadows of fossil fuel generation. That is an equity issue. That solves the equity problem, rather than saying, well, because there could be what they call a cost shift, a shift from certain ratepayers to other ratepayers, we should stop it. This is saying, let's actually solve the problem.
Right. And as we move towards energy justice, are you seeing positive signs in the new Biden-Harris administration and the Democratic-controlled Congress?
The president has made the commitment to move 40% of all climate investments to frontline environmental justice communities. You know, the devil will be in the details. There's still a lot of work to be done to sort of figure out how to implement that plan. But it is ambitious, and it really shows that the administration has surrounded itself with people who are ready to get to work and who get the issues, get the equity stakes of this climate emergency. And so I'm really excited to see what happens next with the administration.
And what is the Equitable and Just National Climate Platform, and what is your assessment?
So the Equitable and Just Climate Platform was in many ways, I would say, spearheaded by Cecilia Martinez, who is now in the Biden administration as their environmental justice lead at the Council on Environmental Quality. And she and others who were sort of diehard environmental justice advocates pulled together a coalition that was comprised of the traditional big green organizations as well as some of the traditional environmental justice advocates and organizations, and they came together and said, look, we want to fight for a more just climate future, and we're going to work together to do that. And that was very much a nod to some of the deep divisions that have been sown between the traditional environmental justice community and the traditional environmental movement. And this sort of climate change fundamentalism approach really has its deepest roots in the environmental movement and action of the 1970s, where we had tons of funding flowing into organizations like Sierra Club, Environmental Defense Fund, Natural Resources Defense Council to fight the bad, right, with respect to the environmental movement. And we saw a ton of legislation being adopted in the 70s. But then we got to the 80s, communities of color said, wait, all of this legislation, all of this advocacy, all of this money flowing into the environmental movement has not benefited us one bit. And we saw communities in places like Warren County, North Carolina, saying, we are tired of being the dumping ground for industry and we need laws to work for us. And so thus sprang the environmental justice movement. And so now we're seeing the same advocates who've been in this fight since the 80s are now taking up the energy fight and the climate fight. And it's really beautiful to kind of see them continue in this work. But I really do feel that we're in a moment of transformation where people are picking up the pieces and putting them together and seeing that the environmental justice struggles of the 70s and 80s are linked to the climate justice struggles of the 90s and now. And energy justice, and this is where I come in, is a tool, is a vehicle, a forward-looking mechanism to create policy that actually can help us to resolve both the environmental justice issues and create a climate resilience in the communities that need it the most.
Well, now that I think about it, I'm a low-income senior, and I can't afford to put solar panels on my house. I'd love to. Here I am, an environmental radio host. I don't have solar power. So I'm thinking about some of the suggestions in your books, like green banks or other incentives. How can we get this going off the ground for the rest of us?
Sure. Well, I'm thrilled, you know, to think about the possibility of green banks proliferating around the country where, you know, either at the state level or the federal level, depending on, you know, how things shake out. But, you know, absolutely providing opportunities for people to get access to low-cost capital. And because people are low-income, they sometimes don't meet the traditional credit metrics for, you know, traditional banks. And I think green banks have a particular role to play because if they're coming from the public purse, they can actually backstop more traditional loans, providing a guarantee, for example, or, you know, provide low interest loans themselves to allow for low income folks to participate. Because again, a traditional bank is not necessarily, doesn't necessarily have the appetite to take on quote unquote riskier customer. The other part of that, though, is utilities, I think, have a role to play. On-bill financing is one way that someone like yourself might be able to eventually pay down the cost of solar panels and own them outright. I mean, may I ask you a personal question, Alex?
Absolutely.
Do you pay your electricity bill?
I do.
Great. Most people do because they see it as an essential service, and most low-income people do. And so this is something that isn't always factored into creditworthiness. And so what I argue for in the book is the mechanism of on-bill financing, which isn't a new and novel idea, but I think one that could really gain traction to ensure that low-income people actually can say, I'm going to invest in an asset through my electricity bill and pay down that asset monthly for a certain amount of time. And then at the end of that payment period, I'll have free electricity and I'll actually be able to sell it back to the grid to support my community through clean energy.
There's so much here. Shalonda, do you have a website, a Facebook page or a Twitter handle you want us to know about?
Oh, my gosh. I am so horrible at that stuff. I don't, which is absolutely terrible. But, you know, these ideas are getting out there. I'm grateful for all of my friends who tweet on my behalf. So I apologize. I'm not in that world right now.
I understand. I only go on Twitter once a week to tell people about the show, and then I'm off. But I know it's a powerful vehicle, and we all have to get going on it. Listeners, I recommend stretching out quite a bit with Shalonda Baker's new book, Revolutionary Power, An Activist's Guide to the Energy Transition. And you can find it wherever books are sold, but I'm going to put links to help in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Shalonda, thank you so much for helping us do this a little better.
Thanks so much, Alex. It was really a pleasure to meet you and talk with your listeners.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. As we heat up the planet with more greenhouse gases, everyone talks about a natural solution. Protect world forests, plant billions more trees, and use agriculture to capture carbon. New science questions that. A January paper published in the journal Science Advances warns, quote, "The temperature tipping point of the terrestrial biosphere lies not at the end of the century or beyond, but within the next 20 to 30 years. We've reached the lead author, postdoctoral scientist Catherine Duffy at Northern Arizona University. Catherine, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we dive into the upper limits of plants, why is it so important for not just scientists, but the public, to understand what your new global review of plants tells us?
So one important finding, whether you're a scientist or not, is that the terrestrial biosphere, which is made up of all the plants on the Earth system, we treat it as one of the main spheres in the Earth system. I was trained as an Earth system scientist, so I just wanted to define that. Between the terrestrial biosphere and the oceans, together they pick up almost half of all of our carbon emissions that we anthropogenically emit. The terrestrial biosphere is absorbing about 30% of those. And if the terrestrial biosphere were to stop or slow that pickup, it would result in ever-increasing quantities of carbon dioxide, for example, in Earth's atmosphere, which feeds back into global warming and climate change.
Is this warning, and I consider it a warning, is it based on theory or models, or can your team back it up with hard data from observations on the ground?
Yeah, so in order to complete the analysis that you're talking about today, we actually use the largest and longest-lived carbon monitoring network called FlexNet. And FlexNet is a network of towers all over the globe. It's a collaborative effort. The data is open. And these towers are measuring CO2 exchange between the plant communities and the atmosphere. So the data is absolutely backed up. Anyone could reproduce it. It is also grounded in basic principles of thermodynamics. So we kind of went back to first principles for this analysis and said, how does this work as a function of temperature? And we threw 2.5 decades worth of data at that question.
So I guess listeners will want to know, well, why does this matter? So how much of human greenhouse pollution is currently safely captured by land plants? What's the estimate for that?
About 30% currently.
So for everything we put up, about 30% of it is being grabbed by plants and brought back down into their structures or the soil.
Exactly. And then those plants, often if they're larger plants like trees with big stems or boles or trunks, then that carbon is often stored for a longer period of time, and or it is incorporated into soil for longer-term storage as well. If the terrestrial biosphere slows this accumulation, it's not only the atmosphere that is changing as far as the quantities of greenhouse gases, but the potential storage in the Earth system could also be altered.
So you're a specialist in something called phenology. What is that, and how can that help us measure climate change?
Yeah, great. It's cool to see that you dug through. So phenology, one way to think about it is it's the timing of living things. So if you think about leaves essentially creating buds and then leafing out and then maximum canopy greenness, and then in the fall, if you're a deciduous tree, senescence, where the leaves turn red and orange and then fall, that's really one example of phenology, but you can also witness phenology in animals and things like that. I spent the last couple of years building a bunch of software to help other scientists do cross-scale integrations of phenological data, everything from satellites to digital repeat photography cameras and in situ on the ground observations. But phenology is important because we're talking about global warming and increasing temperatures, and a lot of scientists have asked, as we're warming, could plants potentially have a longer growing season? Could that be important to consider as a potential impact for climate change? Like, you know, could we green the Arctic? Could plants photosynthesize for longer? The jury is still out on that. For some plants, it really matters how much daylight they have and what we call photoperiod, and that really signals their timing. For other plants, perhaps additional temperature could extend their growing season, but kind of from ecosystem to ecosystem all over the map, we are very actively trying to unpack that question, and the jury is still out. We're not sure.
What made you and your team suspect there is a tipping point for carbon capture by plants?
Yeah, interestingly, we didn't pursue this analysis looking for a tipping point. We actually just sought out to generate a temperature dependence curve for global photosynthesis, and that is important because we needed to understand what was the temperature maximum for photosynthesis for land carbon uptake. And we weren't really thinking about being on the brink of that threshold. We just wanted to generate that curve because it helps us understand things like future climate change, the accuracy of terrestrial biosphere models, which are really key in understanding future projections of global warming. Essentially, if you look at all of the best models for the terrestrial biosphere, when you look at temperature, they say completely different things. It's a total spaghetti plot. And so we need to understand that relationship better. So we threw, you know, 2.5 decades worth of data at this question. And as we generated those temperature dependence curves, we had this sort of, oh no, moment where we said, wow, the last decade, which is also the warmest on record, during that last decade, we started to cross this temperature threshold for peak photosynthesis. And that wasn't something we went in looking for. It wasn't a question we necessarily thought we would be answering. But as we generated those temperature dependence curves, we can now see where we are today relative to that temperature maximum. And when we discovered that over this last decade, we have begun to spend time past that temperature maximum for land carbon uptake, what it brought to light was that any, and I mean any additional warming, gives us more time past that temperature maximum. And what that means is that photosynthesis is now in decline. And so it's starting to slowly enact some of these tipping points that we bring up in the paper.
So yes, your paper looks at heat limits for two kind of opposite operations when it comes to carbon dioxide. We have photosynthesis, where it grabs the carbon, and respiration, where it releases it. Could you describe what you found as far as the temperature limits for those two different processes?
So there's two main processes that cycle carbon for the terrestrial biosphere. The first is photosynthesis, which is that take-up of carbon. And then the second is respiration, and that is the release of carbon via plants, microbes, bacteria, things like that. And so we need to consider both when we're thinking about a carbon balance or a carbon budget. One of the alarming things that we found in our study, and that is corroborated by experimental data, is that the temperature maximum for that release of carbon is actually far higher. It's somewhere in the realm of 50 to 70 degrees Celsius. What that means is that when photosynthesis is declining because of global climate change, because of warming, it's actually concurrent with an upswing in the release of carbon. And that is one of the tipping points we bring up in the paper. It's this reversal in the land sink of carbon. Instead of the terrestrial biosphere taking in carbon and storing it, it could potentially flip the sign of that signal and release it.
You know, I operate an experimental geothermal greenhouse here in southern Canada, and most of my plants, I can see, they begin to grow vigorously around 65 degrees Fahrenheit or 18 C. But around 95 degrees, it's just getting too hot, 35 C. Most of the growth stops. The plants are just protecting themselves from the heat. So this looks like we're going to get periods of that maximum heat appearing in different parts of the world. It's not evenly spread. I looked at the maps in your paper, and some places get hit harder than others and sooner than others.
Absolutely true. And that's so interesting with your greenhouse data, because that's very much in alignment with what we found in our study. Around 18 degrees Celsius is sort of the sweet spot for C3 photosynthesis, which is, you know, you can think of trees and those types of plants. There's also C4, which are grasses, and those evolved to grow during periods that were like warmer and drier. Yeah, so there's a couple, when we're looking at where these temperature effects will come into play first, sort of where and when, there's a couple of things to think about. The first is that warming is not uniform. For example, the Arctic is warming much more rapidly than a lot of other regions of the globe, and it is actually one of those biomes that we see pass the thermal maximum for photosynthesis quite rapidly. And it's a little surprising, right, because we think of boreal forests and northern forests as, quote-unquote, temperature limited, but essentially, because they've aligned themselves within current climate, as we change that climate very rapidly, they are some of the first to experience these shifts past the temperature maximum. Now, the opposite end of that spectrum, as far as like what's driving this change, could be seen in tropical rainforests. And that is actually because tropical rainforests are already quite warm. So even a little bit of warming pushes them past these temperature thresholds for peak productivity or peak carbon uptake.
Have we already seen some of the first plant carbon tipping point temperatures show up in some places?
We have. What was really interesting when we generated this temperature dependence curve is it sort of helped give us a perspective on some of these drastic heat wave events that we've seen over the last decade. One that comes to mind was a heat wave in the early 2000s in Europe, and we saw a complete cessation of the uptake of carbon by land plants during that heat wave. And so now we can sort of place into context some of these extreme events. I think the big question, the big looming question for me, and one that I would like to tackle, is how often and how many of these extreme events can the terrestrial biosphere sort of, quote-unquote, take before we start to see drastic alteration of these ecosystems, things like mortality, things like migrations of sort of ecosystems and ecosystem type.
Well, and the thing is, in my experience, plants don't just turn on and off like a light switch. If you put them under extreme stress, whether it's heat or cold, they can become stunted and they don't really reach their full potential. We saw in the 2010 Russian heat wave that about half of the wheat crop of Russia was lost. So I think there could be two kinds of carbon loss here, really. You have the carbon loss that occurs when the plants stop, let's say, temporarily growing during the heat wave. So that's carbon that could have been taken out of the atmosphere, but it wasn't. But then if it goes too far and the plants die, they release all their carbon. And we've seen that with some forest fires, wildfires, and forest burning, releasing their carbon.
Absolutely. And one of my co-authors on this paper, who was also my PhD advisor, Christopher Schwalm, has done some amazing sort of questioning of the resilience of the terrestrial biosphere to drought and heat and has some fantastic publications out on that. But what you are stating is correct, is that even one very extreme event can change an ecosystem. And we need to understand where ecosystems are more resilient and where they are less, because we need to prioritize how we help the terrestrial biosphere continue so that it can continue to help us in the future. And understanding that resiliency of ecosystems is a really key component.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Catherine Duffy from Northern Arizona University. People who want to minimize global warming, including some paid by fossil fuel interests, they promise us the extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere will be great for plant growth, so no worries. What do you think?
Yeah, another hot topic of debate, and that is actually something we investigated in the work that we're covering today. So a lot of people think that essentially with additional CO2 in the atmosphere, additional quote-unquote plant food, that the terrestrial biosphere will just take up more and more carbon. Now, we have 2.5 decades worth of data. CO2 in the atmosphere has increased over that period. So we threw that in as a variable and said, does this change our temperature dependence curve? And the answer was no. What's interesting about that, about the CO2 temperature relationship, is you can think of it as two sides of the same coin. So if you have additional CO2 in the atmosphere, with that additional CO2, you have additional warming. And so some scientists think that maybe these two sort of cancel each other out. We found that there wasn't a notable effect of fertilization of CO2. And here's one way that I sort of have been thinking about it as I've seen some of these debates play out across the literature. So I live in Arizona. I live in the desert. And if you were to walk across a hot desert, say you started at sunrise and it was nice and cool, but as the day goes on, the temperatures rise, you could have a never-ending buffet of food next to you, but at some point your body is going to be struggling with the temperature effects. It's focused on its own physiology, and no amount of food is going to help you survive 120 degrees Fahrenheit. So there are limits to this, quote-unquote, CO2 fertilization effect. It's not that it's not real. I think it can happen, but it's not never-ending, essentially. There are limits to it. Having additional food can help you earlier on in that day when it's not quite so hot, but when you get to temperatures that stress your own body or stress your own metabolism, that additional food no longer plays a role.
Well, the other thing I think some people do when they're downplaying this issue is they say, well, we'll just plant the crops that grow better in the tropics. We'll plant them further north. But I don't know how many people are really ready for a diet of sorghum and cassava and maize as opposed to what they're eating now.
Absolutely true. And beyond just what we eat, I also think about our local economies that rely on the biosphere, things like timber harvest and also the ecosystem services beyond just carbon uptake or agricultural output. Things like microclimate cooling, evaporative, you know, demand, things like that, that have regional areas of cooling that don't necessarily have to do with like planting this crop at that latitude. And also like how those various our human infrastructures have been built around the terrestrial biosphere and how all of those infrastructures will have to shift.
And I know a few scientists set up testing stations for plant-atmosphere relations. I think one was in Manitoba, Canada. Another one was in Alaska. And they heated the soil under controlled plots and then measured carbon dioxide released by the plants, like simulated global warming. Did you check their findings against your study, or could you?
Absolutely. We did look at some of that data. A lot of people call those FACE experiments or free air exchange experiments where you have free air, you're adding additional CO2, you're warming, and you're doing various controls. You have warming without CO2, you have CO2 without warming, and so on and so forth. And those are really important sort of benchmarks for us to sort of check the reality of what we are seeing. I would say first that it is generally in agreement. The biggest difference is that we are taking ambient temperature and ambient CO2 across every biome across the surface of the Earth. What's different about that analysis and some of these experimental analyses is that they are experiments. They're not necessarily 2.5 decades long, some of them are. They're not necessarily as long, and they don't necessarily cover the diversity of ecosystems that we do in the ambient in situ data. And so we expect to see differences. We do see some minor ones, but we did use experimental data as benchmarks in the analysis we're talking about today.
So to be clear about the focus of this paper, did you include things like soil respiration? I mean, there's billions of organisms down in the soil. They have their own carbon release and capture cycle. And then we have plankton out in the ocean. Did you include those things in this study?
In this study, we really only included the terrestrial biosphere. There are CO2 exchange networks that exist over the oceans, but they're quite different. In this case, we really focused on the terrestrial biosphere because it is one of the biggest questions, like looming question marks in the future of climate change and how carbon will be cycled and to what quantity. It's also important to note that, so we're not talking about the oceans, we're also not including things like disturbance events. Hurricanes, wildfires, we're not including things like deforestation. We are truly just looking at the metabolism of the biosphere, of all those plants in the Earth system, and how they are likely to react to temperature.
A number of scientists have suggested that the ocean itself may turn from a sink to a source, especially if plankton is affected by the oceans are really heating up quite quickly. And in a tweet, you said, when the ocean's ability to absorb heat stalls, declines, atmospheric loading will feed into a whole host of land surface climate feedbacks. Could you talk to us about that?
Absolutely. And first, I will caveat that I am no ocean scientist, but I can read the data. And that tweet that I sent out, I thought that that graph was very compelling. And what that graph shows us is how much heat the ocean is currently taking up. However, the ability of the ocean, because of really long-term cycling, the amount, the quantity of heat that it can continue to take up stalls at various points in time and perhaps stops, right? And so if we think about the ocean taking up less heat, where can that heat go? It ends up in the atmosphere, which feeds into the type of work that we showed in our paper, where heat extremes impact the land surface uptake of carbon. So this is another sort of global feedback into climate change potential tipping point type scenario, where the oceans take up less heat, therefore that energy is in the atmosphere, and the terrestrial biosphere experiences it and reacts to it.
We had the Swiss scientist Thomas Crowther on our show talking about planting billions more trees to capture more carbon in the future and help us out with climate change somewhat. I wonder how your new paper affects proposals like that.
I think when we are considering things like seedlings, planting billions or trillions of trees, but we need to think about the resilience of those seedlings to the climate extremes that they are likely to experience and how our temperature dependence curve plays into the future climate of where you've planted that tree. Because just because a tree dies, say a seedling dies, doesn't mean that the carbon is released immediately, but it does mean that it's released in a less stable form or more volatile form. And so I do think that planting trees can be part, but one of many, of the solutions that we can pursue. But we have to think about future climate. We have to think about future stress. And we really have to manage and restore the biosphere such that it will be resilient to climate change. Essentially, we have been relying on quote-unquote free or inexpensive technology, as in nature is the most efficient machine out there. We've been relying on the uptake of these forests, of the uptake of planting trees to mitigate our own impact. And I think that what our paper sort of points to is we can't rely on that service forever, or at least it is more fragile than we previously realized. So we also need to curb our emissions. We need to be conscious of our own decisions. And we need to take this fragility into account when we are relying on the biosphere to pick up carbon for us.
Totally right. But you study how plants react in changing seasons. It's kind of what you do. Won't plants adapt and evolve to handle these hotter conditions?
Great question. And that is one that came up in peer review. And it's one we checked for as well. So a lot of scientists talk about temperature acclimation. So essentially, can plants be relatively plastic? Can they adapt to higher temperatures? Because we have more than two decades of data, we separated the data from the warmest decade and the previous decade, and we chopped it up in other time steps within that time frame. And again, asked, is this temperature dependence curve changing? Is it moving up at all? And the answer is that it didn't. So we didn't see any temperature acclimation. Now, there's a couple of ways to think about that. First, a lot of the terrestrial biosphere are large, woody, long-lived species, right? Trees that are over 100 years old. So how plastic can they be? Migration takes a while, things like that. But also, we should think about the stochasticity of climate change. While there is kind of steady warming, that warming is somewhat chaotic or messy. It plays out in extreme events, both warm and cold, but those warm events or those extreme events are on top of a slow warming. And so the question is, like, how consistent is warming such that plants can really say, okay, now my climate is 2 degrees Celsius warmer all the time, I can adapt to that. But climate change is a little bit more chaotic and stochastic than that.
Now, the only viable international climate control agreement we have is the Paris Climate Accord. Many countries counted their big forests as part of their commitment to keep climate change below 2 degrees C of global mean warming. What does your new study suggest about those plans?
Yeah, so our study calls into question the future viability of us counting on the terrestrial biosphere to absorb some of our emissions. And that plays into things like the Paris Accord with the intended nationally determined contributions. And so when we're in these global negotiations on a country-by-country basis, a lot of these negotiations include things like, well, for example, the Amazon is going to pick up this much carbon. So as the nation of Brazil, for example, we can emit this much carbon because it's about the net contribution. Not to point any fingers at Brazil specifically, but that's like an easy example. And so what we are bringing up is that perhaps instead of counting on the terrestrial biosphere to help us meet emissions goals, we need to really recognize the fragility of that ecosystem service and really prioritize emissions reductions such that we aren't relying on the biosphere to help us meet things like the Paris Climate Accord.
Now, what are you working on these days, Catherine?
One thing that I really want to do is this last year has made me think a lot about epidemiology, given the COVID-19 pandemic. And what I would like to do is take some of the data that you've seen here that we've talked about and combine it with some other data to really look at the terrestrial biosphere in sort of a dose response type of framework borrowed from epidemiology. And what that would allow us to do is to understand what lethal doses of temperature for the biosphere could be, and to, on a pixel-by-pixel basis across the globe, make some projections about what sort of mortality we expect to observe. That's one thing I would like to do. Another thing that I do for a living is I actually write open-source textbooks on how to do data science. And if anyone gets on my GitHub profile, everything I do is always open source, totally reproducible, and I generate materials for people to teach themselves how to do data science.
So how do people find your work, Catherine Duffy?
You can just go on GitHub and look for Catherine Duffy. That's my GitHub username. And everything I do is up there, free and fair use.
I'm going to spell your name for listeners. It's K-A-T-H-A-R-Y-N. Duffy with two S.
Yes.
From Northern Arizona University, we have been listening to postdoctoral scientist Catherine Duffy. You can Google the paper, How Close Are We to the Temperature Tipping Point of the Terrestrial Biosphere? Or you can find a link in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. That's published every Wednesday. Catherine, thank you so much for doing this work and for talking about it today.
What? My radio stuck on CKUT. I don't know. But no, fix it. CKUT. The number one radio station in Montreal. We give you the sun, the moon, the rain, the stars and the mountain. CKUT give you the word.
If only I could find myself, I would be.
Afternoon, you're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing you a wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked to CKT 90.3 FM.